So we're in Romans chapter 3, considering verses 1 to 8. And as we've seen over the last few weeks, Paul is building up his argument and he's preparing to explain to us what this gospel, this great gospel is, what it's all about. But before he can carry on doing that and explain his argument to us, Paul is aware that he first needs to clear up a few matters. You see, Paul has critics, and he knows what they're like, how these critics of his have twisted his words before now. And for that reason, it's almost as if Paul can predict what these people are going to say when they read the first two chapters of his letter. He can already hear them in the background, making their complaints, making their allegations against his teaching, twisting it. And he wants to be ready for them. In 2018, Professor Jordan Peterson was interviewed on Channel 4 News by Kathy Newman. You can find the interview on YouTube. It has about 50 million views. And famously, there's one phrase which Kathy Newman kept on saying in that interview. And it's this. So what you're saying is... You see, to Kathy Newman, Jordan Peterson was just another conservative, sexist, transphobic bigot. And for that reason, he had to be taken down as far as she was concerned. And one of the ways she tries to do that during the interview is by putting words in his mouth. And actually, Peterson is very reasonable, he's very measured, he's very polite throughout that interview. And yet, whatever he says, Kathy Newman finds a way of twisting it and making it sound ridiculous. So what you're saying is, women aren't intelligent enough to run businesses. So what you're saying is, transgender people are responsible for the deaths of millions. So what you're saying is, human beings should run society along the lines of the lobsters. Now, obviously, Peterson never says any of those things, but Kathy Newman doesn't really care because all she cares about is shutting him down. And so she puts those kinds of allegations against him. She puts those words in his mouth. And that's what Paul's critics are like as well. They're always wanting to put words in his mouth. So what you're saying is, Paul, X, Y, and Z. And it's for this reason, then, that before Paul can carry on and explain his gospel further, he first feels compelled to answer these critics very briefly, here and now at the beginning of chapter 3. He's here to explain what he is saying and what he isn't saying, and to respond to those allegations against him. And so this morning I just want to go through those allegations which are put against Paul, or what he expects his critics to be making right now, and I think we can identify three of them here in this letter. And then I want us to see how Paul responds to those allegations. So, firstly, allegation number one. So what you're saying is, being a Jew doesn't matter at all. So what you're saying is, being a Jew doesn't matter at all. Let's just remind ourselves of what Paul has said in this last chapter, or in the last couple of chapters. He's been surveying the whole world, and he has found that all have sinned and all have fallen short of the glory of God. And among the Gentiles, he has found the suppression of the truth, chapter 1, verse 18, and idolatry, chapter 1, verse 23, and immorality, chapter 1, verses 26 to 32. And then among the Jews, he has found hypocrisy and self-righteousness, chapter 2, verse 1. And last week we saw that whatever excuse these Jews might make to defend themselves, Paul doesn't think that these excuses are good enough. But I teach the law, the Jews say. Yes, says Paul, but you don't keep it. But I'm circumcised, the Jews say. Yes, says Paul, but that doesn't change your sinful heart. See, for Paul, both Jews and Gentiles stand before God on the day of judgment. Neither of them is better off than the other. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And yet, it's at this very point that Paul can almost hear the first allegation coming his way. Chapter 3, verse 1. Then what advantage has the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Ah, so what you're saying is, Paul, that being a Jew doesn't matter at all. That Jews and Gentiles are no different from each other. That the Jew has absolutely no advantage over the Gentile in any way, and circumcision is completely pointless. That's the allegation. They're the words which are being put in his mouth. Being a Jew doesn't matter at all. But you see, that's not what Paul's saying here, is it? What's the value of being a Jew? Verse 2, much in every way, Paul clarifies. To begin with, he says, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. It's interesting that Paul says, to begin with, as if he has more reasons to offer. Probably he did intend to say more things, but he just leaves us with that short statement, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. And that's enough for Paul. And it's in that fact alone that we find the supreme advantage of the Jew over the Gentile. Now, there's two words in that statement that I want to draw your attention to. The first is the word entrusted. The Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. To be entrusted is not simply to be given something. If I entrust you with my car, I'm not just giving it to you. I'm not saying take it and do what you like with it. No, I'm saying here is my car, and it's still my car, but I'm giving it to you for this particular purpose. Please, you know, go to the shops and do some shopping for me and be back within the hour. And so it's your job then to look after my car and take care of my car and responsibly do the thing that I've told you to do with it. The Jews have been entrusted with something, not just given something. What have they been entrusted with? Well, that brings me on to the second word here, oracles, the oracles of God. Now, it's not just the law of God that the Jews have been given here. It's not the prophets which the Jews have been given here. No, the Jews have been entrusted, in the words of Paul, with the oracles of God. And actually, that's an unusual word because Paul only uses it once here in Romans. And literally, we could translate it, the words of God. The Jews have been entrusted with the words of God. And it's a small word, but behind that word, I think, is a big and vast idea. The oracles of God, the words of God, I think really includes all of the special revelation that God has given to the Jews in particular, in all of its richness and in all of its vastness. And in particular, I think, those great promises which he has revealed to the Jews for his purposes for the world, the salvation of the whole world, all of that is contained within the words of God. Later on in the book of Romans, Paul will come back to talking about the role of the Jews, and he'll talk about the unique privileges of Israel. And listen to what he says. He says this in chapter 9, verse 4. He says, they are Israelites, and to them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race, according to the flesh, is the Christ, who is God over all, blessed forever. Amen. And I think that is getting at something of the glories and the richness which lies behind that word oracles here in chapter 3. God has entrusted the Jews with his words, and that means something big and expansive. And chiefly, I think, it's the great promise that one day, as Abraham is told back in Genesis chapter 12, all the nations would be blessed through his seed, and one day all the families of the world would prosper through Israel and through this small nation of Jews, this group of Jews who have been circumcised and set apart for God. Salvation would come through them to the world. So what is the value of being a Jew in being circumcised? Well, much in every way. The Jews have been entrusted with the oracles of God, his purposes and promises for the world. It was their responsibility not to hide that message and keep it just to themselves, but in their own limited way to hold it out to the world and live it out and let it shine out of them They were to be this privileged conduit of blessing to the whole world. That is what it meant for these Jews to be entrusted with the oracles of God. And so it's a lofty, honourable, valuable role that the Jews had in God's purposes for the world. Did they have any advantage over the Gentiles? Much in every way. Paul is not belittling that or despising that in the least. And I think this morning we should make sure that we don't belittle that or despise that as well. I don't want to get lost in this big issue, but it's probably fair to say, isn't it, that how we understand the role of Israel is one of the major fault lines in Christianity. Denominations split over this kind of thing. They have all sorts of opinions on how we understand the role of Israel in God's purposes back in the Old Testament and the New, and how those two things relate, and what his purposes are for Israel in the future, and all of that stuff. But whatever view we take on all of those matters, we must take seriously what Paul is saying here. The Jews were set apart for a high calling. And that means that when we read through the Old Testament and we see God's dealings with Israel, we need to be clear that we're not simply seeing there a collection of interesting stories which just kind of point to Jesus in some way or other. The occasional prophecies scattered about here and there which kind of point to Jesus a little bit. As if the Old Testament really is just a bit of interesting background to the main act. A few symbols and types and shadows here and there. And no, I think Paul is reminding us Israel actually, it's more than that. They were integral to God's plans for the world. They were at the heart of his rescue mission. Only through them, that privileged people had God promised to save the world. Israel were the trustees of God's promise and plan for the world. And in a sense, they were the executors of that promise and plan for the world. So Paul's point is, being a Jew is not nothing. It's actually something pretty significant. It's honourable. It's a valuable position. Contrary to the allegation which is being put against him, yes, being a Jew is a significant thing. It does matter. We need to be clear on that. So that's the way that Paul responds to this first allegation, and we need to take what he says seriously. But secondly then, allegation number two is something like this. Allegation number two. So what you're saying is God's purposes don't matter at all. So what you're saying is God's purposes don't matter at all. Where am I getting this from? It's a bit more difficult, I guess. Well, verse 3, what if some were unfaithful is the sort of allegation he's responding to. Paul is anticipating his critics and they're asking him, well, what if some of these Jews are unfaithful? And I think what they're saying is something like this. Look, Paul, you can go on about the privileges and the responsibilities of the Jewish people as long as you like. But you've just said, Paul, in chapter 2, that the Jews have sinned. They've sinned as badly as the Gentiles have. They're hypocrites. They can't keep their own law. This very law that they teach, they cannot keep it. You've said all that, Paul. So, surely, God might have had purposes for them originally, but what's the relevance of that now? They might have been entrusted with this lofty responsibility to bring salvation to the world. But that's not relevant because the Jews have discarded those oracles. They have nullified their whole commission. You've just said that the Jews are all sinners. And surely then what you're saying is God's purposes for Israel and for the world have been thwarted by Israel's sin. Surely you're saying that God's purposes to save the world through Israel don't matter at all right now because they've nullified their whole commission. They've sinned against it. They have mistreated those oracles. They have shipwrecked the whole salvation exercise. I think that's the kind of allegation which might be put against Paul in this passage. Well, what's Paul's response to that? Well, Paul's response to that is in verses 3 and 4. He asks, does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? I think he's asking a rhetorical question. He's saying to them, in other words, so what if the Jews have sinned? Does that really alter God's promises and purposes for the whole world? You know, when you read the Old Testament, as I said a moment ago, you're reading something of the oracles of God. You're seeing those great purposes and plans of promises of God unfolding before your eyes as you turn every page. And it's thrilling, isn't it? With every page you turn of the Old Testament, it's as if there's more and more light of how God is going to use the Jewish people to bring salvation to the world. But as you turn every page of the Old Testament, you also find that there's more darkness. Because at the very same time, the Old Testament is also a story of how Israel have tragically failed to live up to their high calling. Probably the brightest days of Israel are during the reign of David and Solomon. You know, here we have David, this anointed king. And he is a man after God's own heart, and he's on the throne of Israel. That the period of the judges was awful. Every man does what's right in his own eyes. It's all chaos and darkness and immorality because they don't have a king. And finally, God sends them their king. And there he is, ruling in righteousness. And then we look at Solomon, his son, the wisest man in all the world. And it's a reign of peace and prosperity, isn't it? And the nation of Israel is looking bigger and healthier than it ever has done. And the Queen of Sheba comes to visit Solomon. And the temple is constructed. It's a reign of prosperity and goodness. And yet, at the very same time, all of the seeds of disaster are right there, aren't they? David's eyes get the better of him, and he sees Bathsheba and he commits adultery against her. And then Uriah, her husband, is killed by David. And from then on, David's reign is just beset with problems, and his child dies. And one of his sons rapes his daughter, and another son rapes and murders that son. And then that other son starts a civil war before he himself is killed. And it's just a complete bloodbath, all because of David's sin. And you look at Solomon's reign, and again, it looks good. And you read through 1 Kings chapter 10 and 11, and you see in those chapters all of this prosperity. But even as you read through those chapters, those very same chapters, you see all of the worrying signs. You see Solomon multiplying for himself chariots and wives. Solomon disobeying the requirements of Deuteronomy and ultimately being led astray by the false gods of those many wives. And then you carry on reading through 1 and 2 Kings, and the picture you have there just gets darker and darker. And that kingdom of Israel divides into two, the north and the south. And in the north, things are horribly bad. Idolatry sets in almost immediately. All of the kings in the north are wicked. One king is assassinated after another king. It's just a long line of assassinations, that book. And finally, the north falls to the Assyrians. And then you look at the south, and things are a little bit better in the south, but not much. And eventually, God's judgment comes on them as well. And the temple is destroyed and Jerusalem is razed to the ground, and both nations, Israel, goes into exile. And after that, what is the history of Israel? Well, it is just a long line of oppressing empires: Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Romans. And yes, amongst all of that, there is this return from exile, isn't there? There is a new temple, and that is a moment of goodness and, to some extent, an answer of fulfillment of God's promises. But on the other hand, it's not very impressive. And Ezra still refers to the people after they've returned as slaves. and the people still fall back into sin as well, and they're marrying the people around them, they're intermarriage with pagans, and they're breaking the Sabbath, and it's all very bad. And so when Jesus arrives on the scene in the first century AD, what is it which greets him? Well, in the main, it's this very sorry picture, isn't it? A nation led by an impostor of a king, Herod, religiously led by these self-righteous Pharisees. And yes, there is a remnant, but there are an awful lot of sinners in that land, an awful lot of poor, wretched people who need his help and salvation. And you compare that picture to Israel's high calling. You compare that to the covenant they were given in Deuteronomy 28. And what you see by comparison is a picture of utter failure. And Paul doesn't soften that picture in any way. Israel has been faithless to their high calling. But here's the really important thing. While acknowledging that, Paul is saying here in chapter 3, that faithlessness still doesn't make one iota of a difference to God's faithfulness. And if God has promised the world great things through Israel, if he has promised that through his people he will bless the nations, then he will do that. He will fulfill that promise regardless of Israel's sin. In fact, Paul says in verse 4 there, let God be true, though everyone were a liar. He's saying, look, even if every person in this whole world were faithless and you couldn't trust a word they said, God would still be faithful. And if God has promised to do something, if he has promised to bless the nations through the seed of Abraham, he will do it. You go back to my illustration with the car. Think about the person in your life that you trust the most, a husband or a wife or a parent or a child or a close friend or a brother or sister, and you ask that person to take your car to the shops for you. And that person promises you, like they always do, don't worry, I'll be back within the hour. And it wouldn't even enter your head that that person might do otherwise. It's still more likely that that friend of yours, that family member of yours, will drive off with your car and will never see you ever again. It's still more likely that they will break that promise than it is that God will break his promises. If God promises to do something, he will be faithful. Israel's faithlessness does not mean that God will be faithless in his promise to save the world. No, he will be faithful. Those oracles, those words of God, they still stand. Paul goes on in verse 4 to quote from Psalm 51, which we read a little while ago. And as we saw when we read that psalm, that is a psalm of repentance. David is repenting of his sins in that psalm. The prophet Nathan has confronted David about his adultery with Bathsheba, and David repents. And we need to, again, imagine this from the perspective of David right now. Think about this psalm. Now, here's David, and as we've said, in many ways, David is the promised king of Israel. In his own way, he is the anointed one. David rules from Zion. His throne, in a sense, has been united with God's throne. And very likely there are people in Israel who really think that all of the promises of the Old Testament stop with David. David is the Christ, they might think. And yet David sins, and he sins badly. And the whole world comes crashing down around him. And his family is cursed by God. And he even prays, doesn't he, in Psalm 51, take not your spirit from me, your Holy Spirit from me. Probably, well, possibly, he's thinking about the way in which the Spirit had anointed him for the task of kingship. That's probably part of what he's thinking. And I think perhaps he's saying there, Lord, don't take your spirit from me, in the sense of, don't allow this kingship to be taken from me. Don't allow your great king of the Jews to be in jeopardy now. See, that the future looks very dark for David and the history of Israel in front of him. But you see, for all of those concerns that David has, he can still say to God these words which are quoted by Paul in verse 4. He can still say to God that you may be justified in your words. I think he's saying there, look, despite my sin and my faithlessness as king of Israel, I know that your words and your promises still stand. They are still justified. In fact, notice the word which is used there, that you may be justified in your words. It's that same word that Paul only uses here in Romans. Oracles, that you may be justified in your oracles. David might not be faithful in living up to his high calling as an Israelite and as a king of Israel, but God's oracles still stand. And then he says in that next part, and prevail when you judge. I know that in the ESV it says when you are judged. I'm not sure what it says in the versions that you have in front of you. But without getting complicated with the Greek grammar, basically it could be when you are judged, or it could be when you judge. And Paul, of course, is quoting from Psalm 51. And in Psalm 51, what we've got there is, in the Hebrew, the words, the active sense of the word, prevail when you judge. So I think that's the best way to translate it here. And I think, again, David is simply saying, I have sinned, but you remain just. And however you deal with me, and however you judge me for this situation, your way will be right, your way will prevail, your judgment will succeed, even if I have been faithless to you. So Paul is simply saying here, and people get lost in all of this, and it is complicated, and people do have different views on this, these texts. But I think, simply speaking, Paul is just saying, look, God's purposes still matter to him, even if Israel sins. That doesn't prevent God from fulfilling his promises. It's as simple as that. And as a point of application this morning, I think we need to remind ourselves that the mess of human sin in this world is never an obstacle to the purposes of God. In fact, more than that, the mess of human sin is the very tool God uses to bring about his purposes in this world. You look back at history, not just Jewish history now, you look back at all of history, and what do you see there? You see essentially a bloodbath, don't you? You see a history of wars. It's one of the ways in which learning history, studying history at university, you try and sort of develop a timeline in your head as to what happened where, and you need sort of dates to hang things on, and you remember, oh, well, this war happened there, and this war happened there, and this war happened in this date, because history is filled with these wars. It is a history of injustices and deceptions and awful things happening time and time again, a repetitive cycle of evil. And you think, what can God do with that? And the message of the Bible is, God can do whatever he wants with that. It is no impediment to him. It's no obstacle to him. In fact, he can take all of that blood and all of that sin and all of that deception, and he can use it actually to bring about the very greatest of blessings. And if you struggle to believe that, remember this. We've mentioned all of the sins of the Jewish people. Well, the greatest sin that the Jews ever committed was the day when they took their Messiah, their Lord and their God, and they mocked him and tortured him and killed him. That was the darkest day. And yet it was also the brightest of days. Because on that day, God took the most evil, horrific tragedy in the world and made it a source of eternal life for which we will be forever grateful. We look back at that day and we see not just the tragedy, we see the beauty and the blessing and the salvation which God has brought to us through it. There is evil in this world. There is evil in your life. History is a parade of evil, but it doesn't stop God being good. That's Paul's point. We might be faithless. The Jews were faithless with their great oracles. And yet, God is faithful and he will deliver what he has promised in those words and in those oracles. Let that be a comfort for you this morning. So we've looked at those first two allegations which are being brought against Paul. But now, thirdly, let us come on to this third allegation. In just a few minutes, I'll try to wrap this up and deal with this a bit more quickly than the others. So allegation three. So what you're saying is, sin doesn't matter at all. What you're saying is, sin doesn't matter at all. You see this in verse 5, don't we? But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath upon us? And then we come back and see it again in verse 7. But if through my lie, God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? Now, before I just get into this allegation, notice that verse 5 there talks about the righteousness of God. You might remember a few weeks ago we looked at that idea of the righteousness of God. I was talking about it earlier, and it's very important in the book of Romans, and saw it back in chapter 1, verse 17. And for Paul, this does seem to be a rich and versatile idea, which he has different emphases about on different occasions. But my approach back in chapter 1 was to say, well, in the Old Testament, the righteousness of God wasn't just an abstract quality or attribute of God. No, actually, in the Old Testament, it came to be associated with his salvation, with his vindication of his people. And I gave a few examples back then. Isaiah chapter 46, God promises to save his people from the Babylonians. And he says in verse 13, I bring near my righteousness, it is not far off, and my salvation will not delay. Righteousness, salvation. And then you look at Psalm 98, which we sang earlier. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have worked salvation for him. The Lord has made known his salvation. He has revealed his righteousness in the sight of the nations. And it's, again, these are big ideas, but I think the idea is that there's this moment of salvation for his people where God establishes the right of Israel in the midst of their enemies. He vindicates them. He upholds them. He saves them. When his righteousness is revealed, his salvation of them is revealed. In fact, one of the strange things about that idea of God's righteousness is that at times it even becomes associated with God saving his people, not just from their enemies, but from their sin, vindicating sinners. Psalm 51, at the end of that psalm, David says, deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God of my salvation, and my tongue will sing aloud of your righteousness. So God's righteousness is the promise that one day he will save his people from their enemies and from even their sin. And Paul says back in chapter 1 that in the gospel the righteousness of God has been revealed. It's in Jesus Christ that we have this great vindication, this justification, this establishing of our right. So that is the great work which is promised in the righteousness of God. Well, perhaps now then you can see how this objection works in verses 5 and 7. The critic of Paul is saying something like this. Look, if it really is the case that Israel's sin and darkness and horror, if all of that only magnifies God's righteousness, his salvation of the world, if in fact God uses Israel's failure in his plans to save the world, if Israel's sin only serves God's greater glory, then why am I being condemned for it? Why would God punish Israel if it glorifies him when we sin? So what you're saying is, Paul, surely sin doesn't matter at all. That's the allegation. And I don't think really Paul spends much time answering or unpicking or being technical in the way that he argues back. He simply says in verse 6, by no means, for then how could God judge the world? And then he sarcastically adds in verse 8, and why not do evil that good may come? I think Paul is probably just saying something as simple as this. Look, stop being silly about this. Grow up. You know full well that God will judge the world. You know that sin matters to him. And you know that I know that. So stop playing games. Stop putting words in my mouth. You might as well say, let's do evil things that good may come. And you know full well that that is a ridiculous way to think. And I just want to end this sermon then by reminding you that that really is a ridiculous way to think. You know, Paul tells us in verse 8, doesn't he, that some people really do twist the gospel in this way. Some people have slandered Paul. And they've gone around saying, the Christian gospel excuses sin. It claims that sin glorifies God. And so sin then is clearly no big deal. Christians think sin doesn't matter. Christians don't really believe that God will judge sinners. And Paul doesn't have any time for that slander. He says, God will judge. In fact, God will judge you slanderers. Their condemnation is just, he says at the end of verse 8. Don't slander the gospel. Don't twist it into something ridiculous. God will judge. And this morning, I, again, want to finish by saying to you this. Don't twist the gospel, even in your own heads. Because I think we do that, don't we? You know, as ridiculous as this idea seems, we often adopt it ourselves. We often think along these lines ourselves, don't we? You're caught in a difficult position. You have a difficult decision to make. You can do the right thing or you can do the wrong thing. Only doing the wrong thing is much easier. Telling the lie, losing your temper, taking the lustful glance, having another slice of the cake, pinching something that doesn't belong to you, taking the sinful shortcut. And what do you think to yourself in that moment? Well, at times you think this, it doesn't matter. God will work it out in the end. Even my sin glorifies God. He will save me in spite of it. Therefore, I can sin. It doesn't matter. And Paul says, don't be silly. Don't treat the gospel like that. It hardly merits a response. Because nobody who grasps the gospel, who really grasps the gospel, should ever think like that. And let me just remind you then this morning as I finish. We have a great God. We have a God who has promised to save the world, to save for himself a people. We have a God who has found a way, even through Israel's sinfulness, to restore us rebels, us persistent, daring sinners. We sin again and again and again, and God has not been prevented in being gracious and good and true to his word. God has died for us and suffered for us. What then do we do in the presence of this God? In the presence of this marvelous, gracious, mysterious God and his gospel? What does the sight of that kind of God do for you? When you see the cross and you see among all the chaos and the sin and the darkness, you see the brilliant light of grace shining to you and giving you new life and giving you forgiveness. What do you do with that sight? Do you say, well, I'm off the hook. I might as well keep on sinning. It'll make God even look even better if I sin. No, you don't do that, do you? You humble yourself in love and in awe and you say, no more. I cannot, I will not, I dare not sin against such a beautiful God and against such a great gospel. And so revel in these truths that we've been considering this morning. And the more you revel and the more you grasp them, I trust that you will not find yourself tempted to sin against this great God. No, far from it, the very opposite. The more you see what the gospel is like, the more you see the beauty of it, the more you see the greatness of a God who can save sinners even through our sin, the more you will be led to worship him and love him and serve him with our lives. That is our prayer. That is our hope. Amen.